don't hesitate to ask in the middle, but for now we'll mute everybody so we can at least attempt to get started. Okay, we are going to start the second of Maimonides' 13 principles. If you have a copy of it in front of you, great. Someone just put it on the chat in case you didn't. But the second of Maimonides' principles reads as follows. Ani ma'amin be'emuna shelema, I believe with complete faith, shehabore yizbarach shemo, that the creator, again, we refer to God here as a creator, blessed be his name, hu yachid, he is unique, meaning singular, one, alone, ve'ein yachidut kamohu b'shem panim, and there is no uniqueness like his in any way. Behu levado, and he alone, Elokeinu is our God, haya hoveh v'yiyeh, who was, who is, and who always will be. Just as we did last time, we're going to break it down into three parts. We're going to have the first is that God is considered unique, one. I think just on the most basic level, one of the most fundamental beliefs of Judaism is that there is only one God. It's a rejection of polytheism. There's not two or multiple gods. We can go back to the very beginning of our roots. Abraham, our patriarch Abraham, is the one who gets credited for bringing this concept of monotheism to the world. For the first 2,500 years almost, the world was under the impression that there are multiple gods. There are multiple deities that are dueling forces, good and evil, and they're represented by different things in the world, whether it would be the sun god versus the moon god. But there are multiple gods. This is what the world was under the impression until this fellow Abraham came along and revolutionized with a novel concept that there is only one God with absolute unity. It's the second of our Ten Commandments. Lo yiyeh lecha Elohim acherim. One is not allowed to believe that there are other gods, other deities, other than God himself. If you were to ask any Jew, what is to summarize in one sentence, the motto of being part of the Jewish people, that you're a Jew, everybody would answer, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, Hashem is our God, God is one. That is the creed. That's the motto of being Jewish. We believe in one God, no multiple gods. Now, it's interesting, if you've ever had the opportunity to look inside an actual Torah scroll on that verse of Shema Yisrael, you'll note that there are two fascinating aspects that are different and unique than anywhere else, than in most places in the Torah. The letters, or I should say better, the first word, Shema, which is spelled with a shin, a mem, and an ayin, that last letter, the ayin, is actually made larger than all the other letters. Similarly, the last word in that sentence, where we say God is one, the word for one is echad, the last letter, the dalid, is also made larger than the other letters of the line, or for that matter, any of the regular letters in the Torah. Why is it so significant that you have the letters ayin and dalid? The ayin from the word Shema and the dalid from the word Echad. So our sages point out two pretty simple but obvious, but very, I think, I shouldn't say the word simple. It's quite deep. The simple understanding is that if you look at the letters ayin and dalid and you put them together, it spells the Hebrew word aid. Aid means a one who bears witness. Eidut is testimony in Hebrew. So what this is the testimony of anybody who makes such a declaration of perhaps the most fundamental belief of what it means to be Jewish. I testify, I bear witness, I am an aid, I am dalid, to this principle, that this fundamental belief that there is only one God. However, our sages point out another fascinating point, and that is, the letter ayin. So for most of us, who certainly in the Ashkenazic world, who don't have the correct pronunciation of many of our letters, if you've ever been to Israel, if you've ever had the opportunity to interact with a Yemenite Jew or somebody from a Sephardic land, they pronounce the letter ayin different than you and me. They have it, it's much more guttural. I'm going to pretend I know what I'm doing, and I'm just going to make the sound, but I doubt highly it's correct. It's an ayin. It's with a, it's stuck somewhere in the middle of my throat. It's an ayin. We pronounce it just like it's an aleph. The sound, when you see it in a word, almost you don't even differentiate. So much so that when I teach Hebrew reading, I'm asked this question every single time without exception. Why are the ayin and aleph exactly the same sound? So I sound like an idiot because they're not. But the way we teach it, it sounds the same. Our sages point out so beautifully that the ayin needs to be made larger in the Torah so that it not be misunderstood as if it were an aleph. We have the privilege of living in a day and age of where we have so many printed works. And if you don't have your own particular copy of the Torah, it's two clicks away. One to find it, the other to pay for it. It's very simple. You can get your copy. But in the old days, they didn't have that opportunity. And therefore, most people only heard the words of the Torah when it was read on Shabbat or when the rabbi was teaching, or that maybe there was one copy and they took turns looking at it. I heard a story once, just as an aside, of an older gentleman who only was able to read the text upside down. He had to hold the Chumash backwards. And his family asked him, like, what's up with that? That's the most unusual, weird way of learning. He says, you don't understand. Back before the war, when I was a young child in Cheder, I was in Talmud Torah, I was in Hebrew school. And we only had one copy of the Torah. And we all stood around in a circle looking at it. And my position in that circle was always on the other side. So I learned to read Hebrew upside down. We live in a generation where that's not even a thought. You go ahead and you buy a new Chumash. But if you hear the word Shema, you might be mistaken to think it's spelled with an Aleph at the end. If you spell the word Shin Mem Aleph, instead of correctly with an Ayin, it spells the word Shema, which means perhaps, maybe. Oh, 1 second. That would be a colossal mistake to go ahead and to read, maybe there's one God. Well, that we can't have that. And therefore, the Torah emphasizes it with a large ayin, that it's Shema, which means listen, hear carefully. Similarly, the last letter of the last word of Echad, we said was a Dalet, it too is made larger. Why? Because what's the letter that looks very similar to a Dalet? It's the letter Resh. They look very similar. In fact, again, when I teach Hebrew reading, I purposely hold the two letters together to show how they are different and where you note their differences. The Resh is rounded at the top. The Dalet has a point. It's sticking out. It's dented on the side. What's the difference? Well, here's the difference. Because if you mistake it as if it were a Resh, you would be reading the word as Hashem Acher, God and another, or a different one. Again, that would be colossal and defeat the whole point of that sentence. So the ayin is there to make sure you understand that it's Shema, listen, and the dalet is made large to understand that it's echad, one and only one. This is why it's so fundamental. This concept of where God's unity, God's oneness, is really much the motto of the Jewish people. This mitzvah of knowing God's oneness is, it's one of only six mitzvahs, six commandments in the Torah that one is obligated to have on their mind at all times. You see, eating matzah and not eating chametz on Pesach is a couple of days a year. Today, there is no mitzvah to eat matzah. There's no mitzvah, there's no commandment to eat matzah. And if you want to stuff your face with bread, go for it. There's no problem. It's a mitzvah that's relegated to a certain time period. Other mitzvot are dependent on seasons. Other mitzvot are dependent on other things. There are six mitzvot that are not dependent on anything. They are constant. This is one of them. The mitzvah to remember that there is a God and that God is one. It's one of the first things that we teach a child when they begin to learn, when they begin to speak. Ishma Yisrael, teaching this verse. It's the last words that a dying person says before they expire. We save it and we have it on our doorpost, and our mezuzah is the Shema. You have it in your tefillin, in your phylacteries. It's the conclusion of the Yom Kippur, the Ne'ilah service. And it's the song that was sung by the martyrs throughout our history and the Holocaust. Like Rabbi Akiva, the Talmud tells us that Rabbi Akiva was killed by the Roman persecutors. And what they did is they flayed his skin with iron combs. And the Talmud tells us that his last dying breath, he uttered the Shema, and as he said, Echad, that God is one, that is when his soul left him. Our sages tell us that the point of prolonging the word Echad, right? There are those, if you watch carefully, they will actually enunciate the word Echad, that oneness about God is prolonged to concentrate on the acceptance of God's dominion in all directions, in all four directions around us, as well as up and down in heaven and earth. The great Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, who is credited with founding the Musar movement, the idea of dedicating time every single day of your life for self-development, for character development, to improve one's character. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, when he heard this idea that was supposed to remember God in all directions, that he has dominion over everything in the world, he chuckled and he reminded, don't forget to accept God's unity upon yourself too. It's not just in a theory out there in the world, in the universe. He's talking to us as well. So this is the first point that's being made, that God is one, unique. But you'll note that the Rambam adds a second piece to this. And he says that this uniqueness, there is no uniqueness like his in any way. What does that mean? So I'll use an expression. Sometimes you would hear people who go out and they visit beautiful natural wonders around the world, and they'll say, ah, there's only one Grand Canyon. There's only one Mount Everest. There's only one Niagara Falls. There's only one Louvre in Paris. They use the word one in a very different context. Yes, there may be only one Mount Everest, but that implies that there are other mountains that you compare it to. It may be the tallest. It may be that Niagara Falls is one of the most amazing. No. When we talk about God as one, there is nothing to compare at all. There's nothing in our lexicon. There's nothing in our human comprehension to say God is like this or even the best of these. No, when we talk about God as one, the Rambam makes very clear, Maimonides makes it abundantly clear, there is no comparison to this oneness of God. However, we really have to take it one step further and understand one in a different way. We make a pledge here in the United States, and we talk about one nation under God. Here comes the big word, indivisible. Indivisible. We are United States of America. Now, it's a beautiful concept, but it is not practical. Proof positive, we are 50 states. Each one has their own laws. Yes, there are some governing laws on a federal level, but each state has a level of independence, and for the most part, we are divisible. We try to remain as one indivisible group, as one indivisible nation, but may or may not be true. But what is it when we talk about God as one? We are saying God is absolutely, positively indivisible. Let's explore it as follows. I hope that I'll be able to get this all in the right amount of time. Let's go back to this sentence of the Shema again. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. Many people are familiar that we cover our eyes with our hands when we say that sentence. We cover our eyes when we say the Shema. Why? Why do we do that? We don't do that for any other part of davening, for any other part of the service. Why is that? So the simple answer again is because it's such an important sentence that I need to concentrate. I need to block out any kinds of distraction, and therefore I don't want to just close my eyes because I can still space out. But I do an act that reminds me it's time to focus, it's time to concentrate. And it's a true answer. However, I think we need to delve a little bit deeper. You know, if you look in the world, you look around, we live what seems to be in a world of contradictory appearances. There's a certain sense of duality that the world exists on. There's a sense of everything and its complement, or everything and its opposite. There's heaven and earth, day and night, male and female, things that bloom, things that wither. You live, you die, you eat, you starve, you love, you hate. There's good, there's evil. There's joy, there's sorrow, freedom, slavery, physicality, spirituality. It goes on and on and on. In fact, many of the commentaries point out that that's the reason why our Torah begins with the word Bereshit. The first letter is a bet, not an aleph. I would have expected, based on the wisdom of God, to start a Torah with the first letter. But it doesn't. It starts with the bet. It starts with a bet because the number, the bet is a two. The number two, because when you're describing the creation of our world, it's built on this concept of duality, of where there's two-ness. It's the basis, perhaps, for why there is such a concept of a polytheistic belief, because there seem to be different, perhaps even contradictory forces that are controlled by different deities. You have the love God and the hate God. What we do when we say the Shema, when we make the declaration, Hear, O Israel, and we end with Hashem Echad, God is one, we are declaring it is one single God alone who created, arranges, and guides everything. One origin, no dueling gods, no Greek mythology of where you have different deities slugging it out, and you have to offer different sacrifices depending on what it is you need for that particular time and place. No, we declare Hashem Echad, God is indivisible. Everything comes from God. In fact, you can look at the middle of that sentence of Shema and it says it even more boldly, I think. What do we say? Shema Yisrael, listen Israel. Then we say Hashem. Now, if you, I'm not pronouncing God's name, obviously. I'm using the pseudonym of what we call God, Hashem. But it's spelled the ineffable name of God. It's spelled with a yud, a hey, a vav, and a hey. Familiarize yourself with this name of God because we're not going to get to it tonight, but hopefully tomorrow night we'll discuss this in further depth. But it says yud ke vav ke, God's name. Then it says the word Elokeinu, which is our God. And then it repeats yud ke vav ke, Hashem Echad is one. So either God has a stuttering problem, or there is a much deeper significance to this. So many of you are familiar that when we talk about God, we use different names. And it's not for now. Maybe we can discuss it because it's a much longer conversation. But the names that we give to God are representative of different characteristics. Now, this is an important idea. The name that we use, Hashem, a yud, a hey, and a vav, and another hey, is what is associated with the characteristic of rachamim, mercy, compassion. The name Elokim, the other name that we use in this sentence for God, is much more aligned with what is known as strict justice, din, exacting. If you look out into the world, we are led to believe, perhaps mistakenly, that there seem to be two entities here. There's the good side of God and the bad side of God. The God that seems to represent compassion and mercy, and a different aspect of God that represents strict justice. Good things happen, bad things happen. One's under the name of Hashem, and the other is under the name of Elokeinu. Do not buy it. That is not the truth. Why? Finish the sentence. Hashem Echad. Yud ke vav ke. It's all one God. It's all one. Which one is it? No less. It's the yud ke vav ke, the one of rachamim, the one of compassion. Now I know you're asking the question, really? How about all the bad things that happen? I'm going to shelve it because it is a long conversation, but it is in this conversation 100%. Let me give you one example. It's 10 after already. Okay, let me give you one quick example. And then and then we'll come back. I guess we'll have to come back to this. I'll give you an example in the Torah. We're all familiar with the story of Jacob and Joseph. What's the story here? Jacob is the father, sends Joseph on a mission to go check on his brothers. The brothers have this issue with him, sibling rivalry 2.0, because Cain and Abel took 1.0. And you have, or actually it's really 3.0, because Jacob and Esau had their issues too. But whatever, we're probably at 6.0 at this point. But whatever, you have Jacob and Joseph and his brothers, you have the whole issue, he gets sold, you don't want to kill him. He goes down to Egypt, fine, fast forward, blah, 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 great. Now we have the whole story. He reveals his identity and everybody comes down. Everyone comes down to Egypt. The Torah tells us that fateful moment of where Jacob, who has not seen his son Joseph for 22 years, they finally meet. Here's what the Torah tells us. You want to find it? It's in chapter 46, verse 29. It reads, Joseph harnessed his chariot and went up to meet Yisrael, his father, in Goshen. I'm reading the words carefully. He appeared before him, fell on his neck, and he wept on his neck excessively. A lot of pronouns there. He went up, Joseph went up, met with his father Jacob in Goshen. They embrace, and he, in the singular, starts crying exceedingly on his shoulder. Rashi and all the commentators like, who's crying here? So they all point out that it's Joseph who's crying. And of course, the obvious question is, why is Jacob not crying? Note that the verse specifically goes out of the way to say it in the singular. It should be they wept, they cried. Why is it only in the singular? So the Talmud, Rashi quotes the Talmud, that Jacob at that moment was uttering the Shema. Really? You couldn't do it 2 minutes earlier? You can't do it 2 minutes later? Come on, Jacob. It's early enough in the day. You probably can get it in before it's too late. Now you're saying Shema? Why? The answer is given as follows. And that is, you have to put yourself in Jacob's mindset. What was Jacob wondering for years? He must have wondered, what is all of this tragedy of losing Joseph? How can this be part of God's plan for his benefit? How can this possibly be? To lose a child, like, how does this fit in? And 22 years, he's bugging out. He doesn't know what to make of this tragedy. And now he sees Yosef. He sees Joseph, and he hugs him, and he now gets a sense, oh, there's a much bigger plan in place here. Joseph made his way down to Egypt. He laid and paved the way, the foundation for the entire Jewish family to come down to Egypt, settle there, and survive. We celebrate Passover, which is the Exodus. Yeah, but the beginnings all started now. Yosef was the viceroy. He set things in motion that had repercussions for hundreds of years that ultimately was a saving grace for the Jewish people. Yaakov at this moment now understood for the first time in decades how Yosef was now preparing the path for saving the Jewish people in exile. And therefore, at that supreme moment of understanding, he said Shema. He said, at first I thought it was Hashem versus Elokeinu, God versus God. But I realize ultimately it's Hashem Echad. It's all one God with a master plan. We don't always get to see it, not in 2 years, not in 22 years, maybe not even 200 years. But there is a plan, and that is what the sentence, and that's the statement of Hashem Echad really means. I'm gonna end here. I know I'm in mid-thought, but we'll pick it up here tomorrow night. Bear with me. It's worth coming back for. Any questions for now?
I have a question.
Yes.
With what you were talking about, because I'm reading different things now. Would Job be a good example also, what you were talking about?
So yes, I think Job is an excellent example. Why? How was he able to hold on to his faith for so long after suffering the way he did? Because he had an underlying, a fundamental understanding that it all comes from the same loving God. Why he goes through the travails, why he goes through all of those tragedies, that's an excellent question under the category of why do bad things happen right. to good people? It's a fair question. But the underlying faith that carries a person through is this idea, Hashem Echad. There is one source, one God, one supreme being and authority that is the origin of everything. And I trust in that. All right. We'll pick it up tomorrow night. Thanks for hanging in for the extra time tonight.
Thanks, Rabbi.
Thank you, Rabbi.